Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the lovely, the delightful, the ninja-clad, hoodie-wearing, left-wing...
You love it when I dress like this.
...assassin that is Van Badham. Oh, I should also say New York Times columnist Van Badham.
Thank you, Ben. I am officially now. Well, I don't have a contract, but, you know...
I've started. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. It's more than most people can claim.
Our dog Germanicus is also joining the discussion by pulling on my arm in quite a painful fashion. So sorry if I sound a bit pained. What are we talking about today, Ben?
Today we will be talking about the debates between Trump and Biden.
Oh my. Oh my.
Yeah, if you weren't already exhausted enough by watching it, now we're going to talk about it. We're also going to talk about the changes with JobKeeper and JobSeeker. These are, I call them changes, but that's euphemistic. They're cuts, really. That's what's happened. We might also touch on why there are still problems with JobKeeper even 6 months in. There is some really good news about saving whales in Tasmania, which I'm really looking forward to talking to.
And I believe we're going back to the waterfront for a bit of war as well.
If we have time, we absolutely will. It does seem like Morrison wants to send in the troops.
Oh, well, that's reassuring. No problem.
Yeah. First up, what we have to talk about is the debate, the American presidential debates. Van, what happened?
Oh, Ben. So the debates are a tradition of American politics. Typically, they have three between the two presidential contenders and they have one between the two vice presidential contenders. And they're always a highlight because it's an opportunity for Americans to see how the candidates play off against one another. Usually, it's where Americans get an insight into the personality of the candidates if they haven't been following the race too closely and get a feeling. It's particularly important for like independents and swing voters to get a sense of the options.
Yep.
Famously, in the last round of debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, Trump used I believe the term is aggressive debating style, yeah, where he physically chased her around the stage. Hillary Clinton has since said that her greatest regret is that she didn't swing around and say, back off, creep, when she could feel him literally breathing down her neck in that particular forum. Obviously, the debates don't win elections because Hillary Clinton was declared the winner of all three of the presidential debates and obviously lost to Trump in the Electoral College, if not actually the popular vote, which she won by 3 million people or the entire population of Uruguay. So I've just watched Biden versus Trump, and I've got to say, I watched all the debates last time round, and Trump this time was worse. So obviously, Trump is now the incumbent. He's not the challenger. He can't run on what he will deliver. He has to run on the record of the past 4 years. And it's typical of what we'd associate with a man who has been called out as giving false or misleading statements 20,000 times since he became president of the United States. There was a lot of, I'm the greatest president for African Americans ever, which is difficult to square with a president who's, you know, governing over race riots across the United States. Yep. He accused Biden of supporting things Biden didn't support. He constantly spoke over Biden and the interruptions were just relentless. He also abused the moderator, Chris Wallace, who's from Fox News,
yep,
who's a very sort of mild-mannered man, was like, Mr. President, let the vice president speak, let Mr. Biden speak, please. And yeah, well, you know, blah, 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 this kind of weird bluster. Conspicuously, he was asked to call out and denounce white supremacists and he wouldn't. He actually named the Proud Boys, who are a fascist organization in the United States, by name and told them to stand back and stand by. So the Proud Boys are on Twitter right now putting out material saying the president's behind us and they've done a logo that says Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
So hang on, can we just, I think we've got to touch on that.
I'm a bit emotionally rocked by watching that debate and I'm not the only one. Twitter at the moment is an absolute barn fire of people going, what did we just see?
Because he has name dropped a fascist neo-Nazi organisation and told them to stand by. That's the sort of thing that you would do if you were trying to plot a coup, have an armed rebellion. I mean, that's an incredible and an extraordinary thing for a president of the United States to actually do.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And it was it was really, it was in the context, like, they had been named by the moderator that, that, you know, as one of the organisations that Donald Trump has been hesitant to denounce. And Biden kept saying he's been asked to, he's been asked to tell white supremacists to stand down and to denounce them, and he won't do it. And that was genuinely shocking. That was a genuinely shocking moment. The other really shocking moment was, I mean, obviously, Trump going on about, we're going to have the cleanest, most immaculate water and air, despite the fact that he stripped all of these environmental regulations. Like, it's just the kind of fantasy land stuff that we're used to. But for me, the really outrageous moment was when Trump repeatedly laid into Hunter Biden, who's Joe Biden's son, and laid into him for having formerly had a cocaine problem. Hunter Biden, of course, was one of Biden's two sons who were trapped in the car accident that killed their mother and their baby sister when they were small children. Mm. And I think have probably seen, of course, the other brother, Beau, is now dead from cancer. I think that family has seen more tragedy than most. And to absolutely rip into Hunter Biden's drug addiction, an addiction, by the way, he's taken control of and managed and has been in recovery for a really long time, was a really brutal moment. And Biden really arced up and was like, I'm not a person from the only family in America that's ever actually struggled with drug abuse. And you saying this is just outrageous.
Well, it is outrageous, isn't it? Because Donald Trump has stuffed the White House halls with his own family and toadies and people who've married into the family. And fundamentally, there have been question marks about some of Donnie Trump Jr.'s recent behaviour and whether that's been inspired by substance abuse as well.
Well, this is the thing. You know, we don't know what we don't know. We can't presume. What we do know is that the leak of tax records that went to the New York Times, Trump famously has been promising to release his tax returns for the past 4 years and has not done so, with very spurious excuses. And this, of course, came up in the debate and Trump just waved it aside. Again, oh, yeah, no, I will release them. Oh, yeah, no, but the New York Times has got is not true, is the exact same figure that was used to pay consultants that were in the Trump tax returns is the exact same figure that Ivanka Trump declared that she had earned in consultancy fees from an unknown employer in her own White House declarations. So it certainly seems that when it comes down to family scandal, is it a scandal that a person in a family that has suffered enormous trauma has fought and overcome drug abuse, or is it a scandal that White House employees who are the children of the president are making fairly dodgy financial declarations? I think we know which is the greater threat to American national security. But it was really extraordinary. Like, Trump's performance was belligerent, hostile, and Biden said before the debate that the largest challenge was not taking the bait.
Yeah.
That he couldn't lose his temper. And when the stuff came up about his son, like, Biden is famously a family man. This is a man who was notorious in Washington for leaving Washington and going home on the train to Delaware, where he would, in order to spend time with his family when his boys were growing up. And given all the tragedy that had happened, he maintained a very close connection to his family. And you could just see the raw fury. As far as I'm concerned, Biden deserves to be president, you know, despite anything else, because he didn't rip the mic from the lectern and club Trump to death when Trump was going his children, which was just extraordinary. Other things that came up in the debate, obviously Biden mentioned that Trump has never called out the information about Russian Russian bounty on the heads of American troops.
Yeah.
That was brought up. Trump sidestepped it. The suckers and losers reports about that's what Trump thinks of the military. And all of this is consistent with things that Trump has said, particularly about John McCain, about how he was a loser because he got captured despite the fact he was tortured for 5.5 years by the Vietnamese. That kind of stuff. And Trump's just fake news, fake this, fake that. He also blamed the forest fires in California and on the West Coast. This is Trump, of course, not on climate change, but on poor forest management. We got like a good 5 minutes of that. And it was just unhinged. Like, it was the fantasy land stuff. And it was difficult to think, watching it, it was just like, this is so awful. Like, I can't believe this is the most powerful superpower in the West. And the level of debate is, your son did coke, you know, that kind of, it was just awful. And the constant interrupting and speaking over. But the worst part is that, you know, that the Trump base loves this stuff.
Yeah, that's
like the
right.
People who go to the Trump rallies, you know, they're into it. And yeah, he punches hard, he punches back, blah, blah, blah. And I was watching it thinking, I don't know anybody who would be persuaded to vote for Donald Trump by this performance. I can't see any swing voter coming over. I can see the base coming out for him. But the position that Donald Trump is in is that he actually won over Clinton because he didn't win the popular vote by a very, very narrow margin. And some of those swing states, the Electoral College, because you have to win state by state and this pool of electors who then go on to elect you, that actually came down to just handfuls of votes in various states like Wisconsin. And Trump can't lose any of them. Trump cannot afford to lose a single person who voted for him in 2016. At the same time, Biden is a lot more popular than Hillary Clinton and has brought over communities, particularly of ex-Republicans or Republican-leaning independents who typically either sit out elections or vote for the Republican candidate, who are like, national security is on the line, he's slagged out the troops, he's behaving in a unconstitutional way, like traditional sort of centre-right positions and norms in America Trump has no respect for. But two really interesting things came out of the debate that gave me a bit of encouragement as somebody who wants, I absolutely want Biden to win, like I'm not going to hide that. He and I don't share a lot in common politically, but he's not a dangerous lunatic, so I think, you know, he deserves my endorsement at this point.
Yep.
You know, I would vote, I'm like one of those voters who'd be like, can of tomato for President of the United States. Yeah, can of tomato. And one of the interesting things that happened was that the Never Trumper Republicans, who of course are running this amazing Get Out the Vote campaign to get Republicans to vote for Biden rather than Trump because Trump's dangerous, they were focus grouping and they were doing like live focus groups during the broadcast of the debate. And there was this amazing woman called Ruthie from Pennsylvania who was like, I was undecided at the beginning of this debate, but watching Trump act like a crackhead, and that's what this woman said, was like, I can't vote for him. I'm now going to vote for Biden. And that was certainly an attitude that you could sort of see playing out because Trump was so off the hook. But the other thing that was really interesting is that a lot of people turned off, like a lot of people couldn't watch the debate because Trump was just speaking, it was just shouting and speaking over it. At one point, Biden said to him, shut up, man, like, which was incredible. And there was another moment when Biden called him a clown, like, you can't believe a thing this clown says, and all this sort of downplaying of Trump. But the idea that Americans would switch off the television rather than watch is really interesting because people like Michael Moore before the last election were predicting that Trump would win because he was television. Like, he was a creature of reality television. He knew how to entertain people. For Americans who feel completely disassociated from politics in their daily lives, they could sort of connect to him as an entertainment figure.
Yeah.
If it's got to the point where he's not good television anymore, that's really quite significant. But Biden also did a really interesting thing, and it was obvious Biden had really prepared. Mm. And for a 77-year-old, let me tell you, he's kind of remarkable how much he was able to remember. Biden kept switching, like, you could see his brain going, don't take the bait, don't take the bait, don't take the bait. And he kept saying, I don't want to talk about my family or your family. And he would point to the audience watching, saying, I want to talk about your family. I want to talk to working class families. I want to talk to the people who've lost someone to coronavirus, more than 200,000 dead. One in six small businesses has gone under in America since coronavirus. You know, there's been no rescue package from Trump. He brought up the fact that under Trump, billionaires have done $300 billion extra of business during coronavirus, where all these other communities are suffering. And he kept pivoting back to the audience, while Trump focused entirely on him or abused the moderator. So, look, I don't know if it will shift votes, but in terms of branding Biden as somebody who's more interested in working class families, which is relevant in those swing states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, polls out yesterday have Biden well ahead in those areas. I think it doesn't bode well for Trump.
Well, that is actually probably some good news right at the end of that.
Yeah.
In that it does seem that Trump is just trying to get his base out, whereas Biden is locking down his base and starting to appeal to swing voters or soft Republicans who just can't stomach the idea of four more years of Trump. It's a remarkable, I mean, I've only caught snippets of it, but the performance of Trump is just horrendous. I think at one point Biden says this is unpresidential, and it really is unpresidential. I mean, you know, you wouldn't expect local government candidates to act like that or you know, state parliaments to act like that. It's the sort of thing you see on those funny videos about, you know, brand new democracies who have parliaments that erupt into fistfights. You sort of half expected Trump to sort of rush the stage.
Well, Trump was either belligerent, lying, or unhinged. They were the three modes of the right. debate, and that was all that was on offer. And the whole, you know, self promotion. It's the greatest economy. It's clearly not a great economy. There was an article out this week that talked about one in five American mothers don't feel they can adequately feed their children. You know, like coronavirus has absolutely ripped through communities, and the combination of the chaotic shutdowns, the lack of PPE, no support to business, businesses collapsing, people getting put out of work, are schools open, are they closed? And there's no central leadership from Trump at all because he's not interested. He hasn't been interested in the coronavirus in months.
No.
And Biden brought up the fact that that interview that Trump did with Bob Woodward, and quite frankly, you have to critique the temperament of an American president who thinks you can just give like an off-the-cuff interview to the guy who brought down Richard Nixon. Like, you know, just totally bizarre, where Trump was like, oh, we know it's airborne. He was saying this back in February and, of course, acting on none of the things that he knew and just, you know, telling everybody it'd be over by summer, it'll be over by April, it'll be over. And now there's going to be a vaccine any minute. And Biden was like, it's fantasy land.
Yeah.
You know, but you could see the frustration with Biden. The other thing I got out of the debate, which was something that I really liked, like Biden has a reputation for gaffes and saying the wrong thing. Biden also famously has a stutter, which he's had since he was a child, and he's spoken very openly about this. In the past, Biden's been very careful to sort of suppress his stutter. And one of the interesting things about the debate tonight was that occasionally Biden misspeaks, but he corrected himself very quickly and he didn't roll on with the words. And sometimes he just let himself stutter, like embraced it. And it was really interesting because I thought about that little boy who has the stutter who spoke for Biden at the Democratic National Convention, Braden, his name was. And that kid, you know, gave this speech to the nation with his stutter and talked about how Joe Biden had helped him. And I just couldn't help but think that maybe that boy had helped Biden as well. The Biden's much more confident speaker being able to embrace his stutter than, you know, just speaking on and then coming up with gaffes because he's
trying to cover up a stutter.
A stutter. So that was something that I took, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but that was something I took out of the debate, and I thought it made Biden's performance a lot more sincere and authentic and sort of a nice moment that, you know, that these things have been de-shamed and it's okay to have a stutter, you know.
Yeah, no, that's great. The presidential election will roll on. There will be another debate, I believe.
Two more presidential debates.
Oh, God, I don't know. Just thinking about
the best tweet I saw was a Hollywood screenwriter who said that was the worst thing I've ever seen, and I wrote Fantastic Four.
Well, that's some nice self-awareness on his part.
America.
All right, we should move on because there are other things for us to cover.
You're going to talk about what's happening with JobKeeper and JobSeeker because they've been cut.
They are. So closer to home, they have been cut. So they have been cut. So there are millions of Australians now who have had their JobKeeper cut from $1,500 a fortnight at the flat rate down to $1,200 a fortnight if you were working 20 hours or more in February or in June. If you work less than 20 hours, you're now going to get $750. Now, let's put that into context. So there's about a million people who are going to have their revenue halved, their income halved. And that's happening right now. So we're in
I'm sorry about all the pings, everybody. I think they're attempts for fundraising from the Trump campaign. Some lovely person put me on their fundraising list. Thank you, trolls.
Won't be getting a dollar out of our house.
No.
As I said, this means that there's about a million people whose income is halved to $750 a fortnight. The cuts...
Well, that's easy to live on in Sydney and Melbourne, $750 a fortnight. Oh, my God.
The cuts are going to drag $9.9 billion out of the economy between...
Great, when we're in an economic downturn. What a brilliant idea of Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg to take spending capital out of the economy. That's exactly what we need. In fact, that's what we did with the Depression, which is why it lasted for so long.
And on top of that, 2.4 million people will go from the $1,500 rate to the $1,200 rate. So that's 3.5 million people who are having their income cut from yesterday or from Monday, essentially. Now, you may not see this turn up until the end of next week, potentially, depending on what kind of payment cycle you're on. But this is a huge amount of money, $9.9 billion before Christmas. In New South Wales, it's 1.3 million workers. It's pulling over half a billion a fortnight out of that economy.
And I just think small businesses will be really thrilled after all the interruption to their trade from coronavirus and all the shutdowns to lose so many customers because of these arbitrary cuts from a Conservative government. Fantastic.
Well, the Retailers Association is already predicting even more job losses. And let's be really clear here. Like, the JobKeeper program was supposed to be a wage subsidy program. It was supposed to be a program that kept people connected to their employer. Now, there's been lots of problems with the program because it wasn't actually set up like that. You know, around 2.4 million people, roughly, were excluded entirely.
Like the staff of universities and
staff
migrant
universities,
workers.
Migrant workers, casuals with less than 12 months service. So you've got all these people who were left out. And that means that since JobKeeper came about, 720,000 people have been sacked by their employer who would have otherwise been eligible for JobKeeper had they not had the short term of being a casual or they were in some other form of employment.
But tell me, millions of dollars in JobKeeper has gone to companies at the same time they're paying millions of dollars in executive salaries. Is this not correct?
This is absolutely correct. So Anthony Scali, who is the managing director of Nick Scali, I believe it's a furniture company, got paid $2.5 million after the company drew down $3.9 million on JobKeeper. And the founder of 1-300 Smiles, which I think is a cosmetic dentistry, you know, bleach your teeth kind of place, paid their founder $1.8 million, which is actually the same amount as they got in JobKeeper. They're both really terrible cases, but I think Harvey Norman, which has come as no great surprise that Jerry Harvey is...
No great surprise there. Jerry Harvey doing something dodgy. Extraordinary, Ben.
I know. It's always the way with him.
Extraordinary.
So their profit went up by 20%, which is $480 million, right? They took nearly $30 million in JobKeeper payments, and $22 million of that went to overseas operations. So part of the JobKeeper problem has been, you know, you couldn't get it for these ground crew because their company was owned by a wholly owned foreign
institute. And this is what happened with Virgin.
This is what happened with the ground crew that was supporting Virgin.
And Donatos and...
Donata. So they couldn't get it, right, because they were wholly owned by a foreign government.
But Jerry Harvey can get millions of dollars and then send it to overseas operations.
Absolutely.
So $22
million.
Ordinary working people lose their jobs, but profitable capitalist enterprises offshore their money.
That's exactly what's happened.
Yeah, I don't like that.
No. So what was supposed to be a wage subsidy has turned into a corporate subsidy.
That's, no way, under a Liberal government. That's never... Oh, no, that's what always happens.
That is sadly what happens. Now, the cuts to JobKeeper, and there's also cuts to JobSeeker. Well, let me be really clear about that too. People on JobSeeker are going from 1,115 a fortnight to 815, and by Christmas they'll be back on $40 a day, right? That's the current
plan. Has been proved as unlivable for some time.
Absolutely. Deloitte says that's going to cut $31 billion from the economy and cost 145,000 jobs. You know, Deloitte are not renowned for their socialism.
No, Deloitte aren't really what we'd consider a Bolshevik enterprise.
And Chris Richardson, who we've had little run-ins within the past, has said tax cuts aren't going to give the economy the boost we need to avoid a depression, and we should be putting more money into JobSeeker. You know, economists are saying these cuts are ridiculous. We should be investing in social housing. We should be keeping JobKeeper up. We should be keeping JobSeeker up. But of course, there is no plan to do any of that.
No, there is still not a jobs plan. I love the fact we've been doing this show for 7 weeks now, and every week there's not a jobs plan.
Not a jobs plan. And let me tell you this, the OECD has expected our recovery to now be the worst, or the third worst in the world. Third worst recovery in the world. We only beat Japan, who...
They were having severe economic problems before coronavirus.
Absolutely. They were very aging population, finding it very difficult to get growth, and South Africa, which, let's face it,
has a legacy of structural problems due to that whole legalised racism thing.
Yeah. So poor South Africa was in trouble way before this started. So we're really at the bottom of the pack here, and 2021 promises to be a very, very difficult year based on the current settings that are we're going forward with. So
I've got to say I'm unsurprised. For a political party that insists they are such great economic managers, there's been no evidence over the course of coronavirus that Morrison or Frydenberg, his treasurer, really have the economic knowledge, willingness or capacity to deliver the kind of programs for the economy that can help Australian working people. Like from everything from the crazy like home improvement package to, you know, the holes in the JobKeeper system, the fact that there isn't a jobs plan, like we're just hurtling through it day by day and there's going to come a cliff. It was interesting, you pointed out to me the other day actually that somebody was warning in a newspaper that the increased amount of money that went to particularly JobSeeker was alleviating poverty and the increased amount of money was enabling unemployed people to have some kind of purchase in the economy that was keeping businesses afloat and keeping other jobs afloat, and that, you know, there was a concern that that reserve army of labour, you know, desperate unemployed people who the existence of which discourages people from putting in pay claims when they do have jobs because they're so terrified of losing their jobs and being unemployed, was that that mechanism within the system would disappear if we got people out of poverty. And it's like, aren't we a society? Do we want anybody to live in poverty, really? And it's like, well, some capitalists do.
Yeah, and it's terrifying. Like, it is a terrifying situation. The budget is obviously next week, and it'll be our show will be on the day after the budget, so we'll obviously talk about that next week. But at the moment, all they're really flagging is more tax cuts, and no serious economist is suggesting tax cuts will work, because frankly, people who have money are squirreling it away. Household savings ratios are going up, so if you're in a job, people are saving money. There is no way that tax cuts are going to solve this problem. There has to be a plan for jobs, and it has to help people back into the workforce and give them decent paying conditions. And until they can do that, we really are stuck having to pay JobKeeper and JobSeeker at higher rates. We have to do it. And the idea that we can just cut them and people will suddenly wander off into the fields and start picking fruit, it's not going to happen.
Were there like 6,000 applications for a dishwasher job in Melbourne the other day?
Oh, yeah. It's out of control. It's out of control. So anyway, we will talk about the budget next week. I just wanted to give people that update because there are 3.5 million Australians who are, as of today, yesterday, on less money than they were for the last 6 months. And that's going to be a real challenge for a lot of people. Very quickly, while we're talking about lacking a plan, people might have started to see there's some issues going on with the docks and Patrick's at the docks 20 years ago.
I remember going to a dinner with you where we commemorated 20 years since the docks dispute with our comrades at the MUA.
I know. And we thought, oh, yep, it'll never happen again.
Pickets on which we both spent a lot of time.
There'll never be another government that uses the army or uses mercenaries to try and remove workers from the docks. And yet here we are in 2020 with Morrison refusing to rule out sending the army to the docks. Now, let's be really clear here, because there's a lot of misinformation about this as well. The union and the workers have offered to roll over conditions with a 2.5% pay increase, right, to Patrick's. Patrick's is the same company that 20 years ago tried to break the union and used mercenary scab labour. Workers have done a few bans on overtime and have voted to take a 24-hour stoppage. I think the total amount of time it's been down is about 4 hours so far. Now, there's a lot of, they're holding the country to ransom and medicines are going to rot on the docks. None of that is true. That is all hyperbole designed to try and squeeze money out of people who are waiting for their goods and to try and get support against the workers on the docks. So don't be fooled by that. Now, the union has offered to stop all actions if the company agreed to not cut conditions, so to bargain and negotiate properly. The company has refused that offer. So now the workers are demanding their full log of claims, which is a 6% pay rise. The Morrison government has already said quite clearly they're going to side with the company, they're going to take it to the Fair Work Commission, they're going to intervene, and they're refusing to rule out using the army, as I said before. Now, the thing that blows my mind about this is that Patrick's was once the largest stevedoring company. That's the people who manage the docks. And after the last waterfront dispute, they declined significantly. And now DP World is the largest dock management company in Australia. And they've already done an agreement with the MUA. They've done an agreement. They're on board. It's all settled. It's all happy families. Things are moving through DP World managed docks. But Patrick's, with their ideology...
Did you hear our dog sigh? Our dog just sighed.
with Patrick's with their ideology and with an ideologically driven Scott Morrison are, of course, pushing things to the brink.
You know, I say bring it on because 20 years ago, the lawyer Josh Bornstein, full disclosure, quite a good comrade of ours, beat 9 legal teams from the Howard government and in order to defend the MUA and resolve the docs issue. And he's an even better lawyer now than he was 20 years ago. So well done, Scott Morrison. I look forward to seeing you fail.
And those workers are really committed. You know, they have made a lot or attempted to make a lot of concessions to make this thing work, and they're just being absolutely railroaded by some negative media and a government that's obsessed with breaking them. So
amazing.
Our solidarity to them as they stand strong.
Yeah, solidarity, MUA.
Now for the good news.
I love good news.
So this will start like sounding bad news.
I know. He's pre-briefed me, so I've already had my teary.
470 whales stranded themselves in Macquarie Harbour in Tasmania last week. Now, it's a terrible tragedy. The good news is that dozens of volunteers, marine scientists, surf lifesavers stood in freezing cold water for hours and hours on end for days to free these whales, and they were successful in saving 109 of them, which absolutely defied all expectation. So that's 109 whales that were saved. And I think...
Thank you, volunteers.
Yeah, thank you very much, because, you know, that's a hard yard. And, of course, at the same time, some whales were perishing, so it's a hard situation to be in and be around. But you've saved 109 whales. The pilot whales were 109 of them were helped back out to sea. And frankly, one of the really lovely stories that comes out of this was one of the volunteers saying that he no longer saw whales as just another fish, you know. And you think how important that might be in the future for people to have changed that mentality. And he helped save 109 pilot whales off the coast of Tasmania. So well done to everyone. I know that there were Department of Parks members down there too, CPSU members who worked huge amounts of overtime and volunteered some of their labour as well in freezing cold conditions. 109 whales saved, Van. That's good news.
That's good news.
All right. That's the week on Wednesday.
Oh, Ben.
We have flown through it this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please email us the week
at... Ping. That's the Trump campaign again. Ben is laughing because he can see these pop up on my screen. And like I said, thank you to the troll who signed me up to that particular list. I found it very educational.
You can get in contact with us
theweekonwednesday@gmail.com.
You can...
We're on Twitter and we always tweet insiders in Q&A from the account.
And of course, any comments, we're more than happy to take on board.
And we'll also be flagging to our following that Ben and I had the great privilege of doing another podcast as guests this week on a podcast about nature's greatest animal, the Dachshund dog. So we will be promoting that on our channels as well as we talk about our dog for about an hour.
So look out for that. Thanks very much for tuning in. Remember to share. Remember to talk to your friends. Remember, we want to grow our listenership. We keep growing. Thank you very much for your support. That's all for today. Love you, Vanny.
I love you too, baby.
Bye.